Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour, July 21st, 2016. And a very important announcement first. I was going to get some sponsors for the show, and then I thought about it, and I didn't. So I'm not going to have sponsors. But anyway, I want you all to go visit my webpage. I have a little announcement, and I'm just going to concentrate on science on this show. I'm not going to do any more conversation about water filters, which is my product. But I decided you can go to my webpage and read all of the information. I'm going to have more and more information on the webpage. And I'm not going to have really any more political commentary. There's so much of that. So anyway, my deal with you, the audience, is I want to keep this a commercial-free, sponsor-free show. Just go to the webpage. When you want water filter products, buy them there. They're the best in the world. And also, I have a new little program. It's with a new feature with PayPal where you can it's called paypal.me. And you can it's a way of contributing towards the show if you want. If you don't want, you know, fine, it's still free. But there's a lot of people. The best thing is to buy some water filter products or my books, and that, you know, the profits go to support this show. And all the other expenses, there's really, monthly, there's a lot of expenses that I have, just routine monthly expenses. So the best thing to do is to buy some products from the page, but a lot of you already have all those, all my books, all the water filter things you need. So it's just a way for people to throw in money. It could be $5, it could be $50, or if you're really rich, you could give me $1,000, but I don't expect that. It's just the PayPal thing is there on my page. I'm not going to say any more about it. Just I'm going to give a reference to my webpage once every show at the beginning and end. And other than that, I'm just going to do science. So tonight's science topic is, I'm going to continue about Jupiter and Saturn because they're such wonderful examples of these star systems that they tell us so much about stars, etc. So I'm just going to go through more about Jupiter and Saturn and our sun and the galaxy. So it's really informative. It has all the properties of comets, everything solar system. Also, I want to encourage you to go to my webpage. I have a center column. You scroll down a little bit on the webpage, jmccsci.com. It's called the Picture of the Day. And I used to do a thing. It was called the Weekly Notes. And that was another place on another part of the page near the radio show. But I decided what I'm going to do is set up the pictures of the day to coordinate with my weekly show. And this week, since I'm talking about Jupiter, I'll have a number of pictures up there with some more commentary regarding Jupiter and Saturn and other, you know, related topics. But so that it'll give you some visuals also. And maybe I'll be able to squeeze in some videos and some other things as time allows. I wish I had a production staff of 30, but I don't. It's just myself. And by the way, it's really raining hard where I am. And so you might hear a little hiss noise in the background. First of all, a couple quick announcements. There has been some, these are kind of misinformation. So if you see these floating around, somebody was saying there's a giant black spot on the sun and the end of the world type of thing. These big black regions of the sun are nothing more than cool areas. That's where the sun is relatively cool, and it's just the sun is like a fire. It's an electronic, it's electrical fusion fire is what it is, and so it's like any fire. It's going to vary. It has variability, and that's one issue. And then there was another thing I saw, and people misinterpret this all the time. They look at the SOHO satellite. And they see these things. They look like a large pixel Indian symbol of a bird, and they appear on the SOHO. That's the Solar Observatory and Heliospheric Satellite that NASA has. It's been watching the sun for decades, And I've been doing commentary on this for decades, literally since the mid-90s when it was first available. But people still misinterpret these. These are actually camera, what are known in the business as camera artifacts. They're not giant spaceships. They're not giant spaceships causing the sun to expand or blow up or anything like that. It's not alien races out there doing something to the sun. And so, at any rate, I just want to clarify that if you've been the subject of emails or seeing articles about this, no, there are not giant alien spaceships, thousands of them going around the sun being seen by the satellite, the SOHO satellite. No, that's not the case. These are what they're literally artifacts. And the same thing happens in your camera. The newer cameras are getting better. But if you had a digital camera a number of years ago, artifacts were something that you would see in your pictures. And they're just little pixel anomalies where the data got scrambled or something like that. And you'd see some pixels that were colored or off color or out of place. But at any rate, so that if you've seen that, you know, just ignore it. That people talking about spaceships, etc. Also, just a quick thing: don't download this Pokemon Go thing. Do not download it. If you give your phone to your kids to play with, or other people use your phone, do not download Pokemon Go. It is a pure CIA tracking monster in your phone. So do not put that on your phone at all, or tablet or whatever. And it's just ridiculous. I really don't see my audience downloading that, but sometimes, you know, you let your kids play with your phone, or, you know, somebody plays music and then they think these, because the advertisements for this thing are popping up all over the place. So anyway, do not download Pokemon Go, it's called. And if you look into the history of its development, it comes right out of the CIA, and you do not want that on your phone or tablet or computer. Just a quick announcement. The Navy reportedly created a 3.7 magnitude earthquake off the northeast coast of Florida this past week. What an insane thing to do, because in Florida, you have a lot of the houses built on sand. I mean, Florida is sand. And there's a lot of sinkhole activity. So if you jar that sand, you could create a lot of sinkhole activity that would not have been there otherwise. I mean, there's the weakness in the sand. But if you start jarring Florida with earthquakes, especially something the level of a 3.7, then good grief. I mean, what are these people? I mean, the world has gone absolutely insane. And the people with the capability of doing this, I mean, what a bunch of complete idiots. The Fukushima earthquake, it was about a 5-point-something, was not a big earthquake over in Japan that they claim caused the destruction of the Fukushima reactor. That's a total myth, internet myth. The actual earthquake was about a 5-point-something and very weak, and it did not cause a major tsunami, as they said. If you watch the full-length of tsunami videos of Japan, these are just rolling waves that came in, and they were started by an underwater demolition. So, and then the actual towers at Fukushima were literally blown up, demolitioned. And that's what happened at Fukushima. But, of course, you're not going to hear that on the evening news. Just a quick commentary on glyphosate, which is Roundup. You know, if you're going to kill some weeds in the driveway or something like that, well, you know, that's handy. But this is bad stuff. You don't want to use it in your garden. You don't want to use it where you're going to plant plants. They used to think, or used to say, or they still say, the producers of Roundup, as Scott produces it or resells it, and it's a Monsanto. Roundup is, a Monsanto trade name for glyphosate. But what glyphosate does is it grabs onto the minerals in the that are available for the plant that the plant needs to grow, in all the enzymes and everything else that are part of the plant growing process, glyphosate grabs onto those and does not let them free. What researchers have found is that previously Monsanto and the companies that sell glyphosate or Roundup have said that, oh, it goes away. You look in the ground and there's no trace of Roundup, so they think it just goes away. It doesn't go away. It's still there, but it's not visible because it's locking up all the minerals in the ground. And so what they're finding is that plants that try and grow afterwards in the same soil don't grow because the minerals are locked up by the glyphosate. And so it's still there. It doesn't go away. It doesn't break down like they say. And so anyway, that's the latest research. I'm just quoting the latest research on this. So in other words, if you're using, if you have a garden or something like that, don't use Roundup in your garden. Go out there and hoe it. And just, you know, get the old-fashioned hoe where you're cutting the weeds at the root line. And after you do that enough, you'll work your garden to where it's a well-maintained garden. That's the old-fashioned way. And, you know, then you have, actually you need bugs. You need a lot of things in that garden that you might think, well, gee, if you just kill everything off, then the plants will grow and they'll be healthy. But there's a lot of things that are in the dirt that the plants need as part of an ecosystem. Okay, well, enough of that. And just a quick note, there's more and more in the news, there's a fungus that's threatening the world banana crop. Now, the bananas that you buy in the store, they're a certain variety, and they started producing those from a natural variety decades and decades ago, about probably 50 years ago, and they decided that was the best commercial crop for bananas worldwide. But as with anything, once you start concentrating a species and growing a lot of it, kind of like the human race, it starts to develop. If something develops that is not easily attacked by, say, a herbicide or pesticide, whatever, then you have the danger of the entire world crop being consumed or destroyed by this particular, in this case, fungus for bananas. And so what they've done is methodically destroyed all of the other varieties of bananas. When I was young and traveling down through the Pacific side of Mexico or down into Central America or in the Caribbean side or wherever I was, the bananas were natural. And it was in that time frame, probably, you know, a good 40 years ago when they started introducing this standard type of banana, and I saw them cutting down plantations and, you know, these little banana plantations, and started with the big companies, the big fruit companies coming in and producing a lot of fruit. So anyway, these are scientific issues that I want to give a little bit of notice on. So if you have, here's my point, if you have bananas growing around you that are natural, of other varieties, maintain them, because those are extremely valuable. They could be the future of the bananas of the world, because you know, the strains that they're using for vast commercialization could be dying out shortly. Okay, so right into the science topics. I'm going to ask 5 questions here, and these questions then I will answer throughout the show. And I like this format. Are Jupiter and Saturn planets or stars? And I've already answered this on previous shows, but I'm going to talk about it again. What are the 2 kinds of ring systems, or not the only kind of ring systems, but the most typical type of ring systems? Number 3, is our sun a comet too? Is our sun a comet? Does it act like a comet? And, of course, if you look at my model for comet behavior, the plasma discharge comet model, literally the sun is doing that in the galactic wind. It is discharging the galactic capacitor. So our sun literally is acting as a comet also. And this is interesting. That's an interesting question, because in the mid-90s, I was working with some Russian scientists who were atmospheric scientists. They also studied the sun, and they also studied the heliosphere and the heliopause, which is the point at which the solar system and the control of the sun ends and the galactic control begins. And so they were studying that, and they couldn't quite figure out all of the phenomenon that were going on until they realized, due to my theoretical work, that the sun was acting as a comet, and then everything fell into place. Should we talk about fusion-based objects versus non-fusion-based objects? And that's a question that has a lot of implications. And then, what's the charge-to-mass ratio between electrons and protons, electrons versus protons? And it's around, I'll start with that last question, and you're thinking, good grief, this is pretty technical for me, I'm going to turn this off. Well, this is a really, really important question, and something that I realized in my early work, that charge to mass ratio was very important. And before I talk about electrons and protons, let's go up to something the size of Earth. Earth is electrically charged relative to outer space. How does it do that? It does that by discharging the solar capacitor. So relative to other regions of space, our Earth region has an electrical charge, and it's negative, just like a comet. But it does that because it's part of an overall electrical discharge. This is one of the things that standard science could never understand or grasp, because I will agree with standard science that if you have a standard plasma situation, and if you take a charged object like Jupiter or the Earth or a piece of dust that's charged, and you put it out into outer space, say it's negatively charged, the protons that are positively charged are going to rush to that charge pronto and cancel it out and neutralize it. And so it doesn't matter the overall number of charges, positive or negative, it's going to work towards a balance of equal charge distribution in a very quickly. So how does the Earth maintain a negative charge, or a comet, or the sun, for example? Well, it's because the sun is controlled by a large fusion reaction, and part of that fusion reaction is the separation of charge. So we would not have all of the conditions we see. We would not have weather. We would not have comets. We would not have rain coming into Earth from outside the planet if it were not for the fusion-based activity of the sun. If you look at Jupiter, it's the same situation. Jupiter and Saturn are small stars. They have fusion in their atmospheres. And this is what really, really crystallized my belief of the fusion-based nature of the solar atmosphere, the sun, our sun's atmosphere, that the sun, the fusion of the sun, the heat-generating source, the fusion fire, was in the atmosphere, not down in the core. And I talk about this next little problem in my course, my Astrophysics, Astronomy, and Space Science. The first is called DVD number 4. Downloadable DVD, but I talk about the fact that there's not enough mass in the sun to, if you take the E equals MC squared equation, and this is only looking at the heat generation of the sun due to fusion, there's not enough mass in the sun, and there never was enough mass in the sun, to produce fusion at the rate that we're seeing it. There's not enough mass in the sun to make the sun burn for 4.5 billion years, the so-called estimated age of our sun and solar system. So with such a basic flaw in that theory, how can they possibly keep talking about it? But they do. And so at any rate, back to the charge-to-mass ratio, the charge-to-mass ratio of Earth is extremely small. It's such a small number that you probably have a hard time counting all the zeros after the decimal point. That's how small it is. So electrical motion or motion due to electrical effects on Earth are simply non-existent. Gravity is the dominant force that has our planet and moon, etc., moving around. And so let's get down to the electron and proton level. The charge to mass ratio, in other words, the amount of electrical charge on the electron versus that of a proton, is about 2,000 times. That means, and this is, and I'm sorry if this is boring some of you people or you think this is beyond your reach, but this is just one little fact, and then I'll get back to a little more dialogue about the planets themselves. But this little fact of the proton versus the electron, or the electron versus the proton, is very important. And it, once you understand it, then you can understand dust particles and rock-sized particles the size of a baseball, asteroids, comets, moons, planets, and stars. Once you understand this very simple fact. But the charge on an electron is a single unit of charge. But the mass of the electron is about 2,000 times smaller than that of a proton. So the charge to mass ratio is about 2,000 times greater for the electron. What does that mean? That means that if you want to move particles in outer space, you have a charge situation. Okay, charges are going to move. The electrons are going to move. The protons are going to move. They're going to respond to this charge situation. The electrons are going to move literally 2,000 times faster. They're going to be 2,000 times more responsive to an electric field than protons. Sounds like a very simple result, but even today, space scientists, astronomers, and astrophysicists do not understand that simple little principle. And so what does this mean? This means that if you have a comet or a planet, planet Earth, discharging the solar capacitor, then the majority of charge that's going to move in that discharge, that electrical discharge, are going to be electrons. Very simple. But what happens when you have a sea of electrons moving and hitting an object like Earth? It builds up a pressure, and a pressure means there's an accumulation, so you get a net negative charge. That's where the charge comes from. But it wouldn't happen if the sun, the fusion-based activity of the sun, were not creating that electric field as part of the fusion process. So these are all the key elements that I had to figure out when nobody on the planet had a clue what was going on. As I was watching space probe data coming in from space probes, I was sitting at Cornell and watching the actual data come in, understanding these principles, and it's like, okay, it's all gelling together. I already had my theoretical work done and in place. All I needed was the data, and it was confirming everything that I was looking at. So let's go back and look at these five questions again. Start with the fifth question. What is the charge to mass ratio of electron versus proton? The electron has 2,000 times the charge to mass ratio. Well, let's look at a dust particle that weighs billions of times more than a proton but has one single charge. We're talking a charge to mass ratio of the electron versus that dust particle billions of times. Not to quote a guy named Carl Sagan, who was wrong about mostly everything he did, but literally, that electron has much more mobility, and that's a physical term. That's a term we use in electronics, mobility. The electron has billions of times more mobility than a piece of dust that has a charge on it. Or let's take a molecule. Let's take a large hydrocarbon molecule or a water molecule. Literally, tens of thousands of times more mobile the electron than that water molecule. So in a comet tail, when the water molecules are being formed from hydrogen and oxygen, they're coming in, they're ionized, positively ionized, they're coming in slowly to that comet nucleus, the electrons are able to go out there and maintain that charge 10,000 times faster than the oxygen and hydrogen atoms can come in and cancel it. Now, that's a very interesting fact. That's what keeps that comet nucleus negatively charged. Now, you understand how important that charge to mass ratio concept is. That explains why, in a discharge situation, the plasma discharge comet model, why an object can remain negatively charged is as a part of the overall discharge process, because the electrons are doing the majority of the charge movement. So the fourth question was, should we talk about fusion-based objects versus non-fusion-based objects? In our solar system, the Sun, Jupiter, and Saturn are fusion-based objects. So should we talk about them rather than being planets? So look at how erroneous standard science is, or standard astronomy, calling Jupiter and Saturn planets when they are fusion-based star systems. They're unlit, but see, when you look at Jupiter in the sky, it's reflecting light from the sun, just like a planet. Saturn is doing the same thing. We're getting reflected light. But unbeknownst to you, the Jupiter and Saturn, Jupiter is putting about 2 times as much heat as it receives from the sun. It's giving off about twice as much, which means that, hey, there's an internal heat source there. Saturn is giving off almost 3 times as much heat as it gets from the sun. So that tells you that something's going on there. Standard science says, well, that's due to collapsing phenomena in the planet itself. Well, no, that does not account for the amount, the vast amount of heat that's coming off of these planets. There's a lot of heat coming out of them. And if you look on my webpage, the center column, the picture of the day column, down at the bottom, the third picture down, is a thermal picture of the thermal output of Jupiter. And what do you see? You see a band around the equator. You see the great red spot, very brilliant, very thermally active. And what's the great red spot? I've already talked about that on previous shows. It's a giant hurricane that's driven by electrical forces from outside. These are electrical currents, and it's the same method that on Earth, the same cause of hurricanes, and I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into that in detail. But the question, once again, should we talk about fusion-based objects versus non-fusion-based objects? So the Earth is not a fusion-based object, okay? It reacts to the overall discharge of the solar capacitor. If we were close enough to Jupiter or Saturn, we would be responding to the fusion-based capacitors of those star-like objects. So you can see now, there's a fine line here. There's kind of a duality in that Jupiter and Saturn produce their own electric fields from fusion, so they're fusion-based objects, and I've talked about this before, but they also react to the solar electric field, which is much bigger, much more pervasive, much more powerful, and they reside in that. So now it's kind of like the flea sits on the back of a dog, and the dog sits on the earth, and you know the earth is in the solar system. It's one of those things. But the sun is in the galaxy. The galaxy has a fusion-based core. The sun is in that. It discharges that. So the sun is acting like a comet relative to the galactic core and fusion-based core of the galaxy. Jupiter is reacting to as a comet. It's reacting, discharging the solar capacitor. And literally, that's what a comet is. It's any object that is discharging a fusion-based capacitor. So that's a fundamental definition, that a comet is not some piece of ice that's melting when it comes near the sun. That's so beyond ridiculous. I can't believe anybody even talks about it anymore, let alone puts it in a textbook or someplace else. I got a kick out of the Paris Air Show. The European Space Agency had its team of comet specialists there, and they were talking about the Rosetta mission to a comet and landed on the comet Nucleus. And the chief scientist of the European Space Agency sat there, and he kind of looked down, and he was rather sheepish, and he didn't want to say it too loud, but he did. He said that basically he had written papers, peer-reviewed papers, about dirty snowball comets for his whole career, and he said none of it's true. He said that model is incorrect, and he said it right there at the Paris Air Show on camera, and he looked like he was about ready to get somebody, let me tell you, he looked real nervous, let's just put it that way. He looked pretty sheepish, and he was looking down. He was kind of like, you know, well, he didn't really want to say it, but he did. And, you know, the news media just talks right over these people. Comets are not dirty snowballs. They never were. They never could be. Here's a great example. The four Galilean moons of Jupiter are covered with ice. Not Io, I'm sorry. Three of them. Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa, those three Galilean moons, Io is the innermost one, and it is not covered with ice at all. It has no ice. It's volcanically hot. The other three, however, are covered with ice. And exactly where Jupiter is would be a place where you would expect large comets to exist, and if they were dirty snowballs or icy snowballs, then those moons should be just blasting away giant comets because they're out in the solar wind. They're not being protected by Jupiter's magnetic field or anything. So they should be giant ice ball comets if that concept really worked, but it doesn't. So there's so many contradictions out there that it's just silly. It's beyond silly to even talk about it anymore. But you have to understand that comets, and this is basically the definition of a comet, the plasma discharge comet model, it's any object that is in a fusion-based capacitor, like the Sun would have a fusion-based capacitor, Jupiter would have a fusion-based capacitor, Saturn would have a fusion-based capacitor, our galactic nucleus has a fusion-based capacitor that extends way out. And any object in that field, now remember that Jupiter and Saturn don't respond to the galactic fusion-based capacitor. Why? Because they're in this nice protective egg, so to speak, or shell that's dominated by the solar, by our sun's capacitor. So Jupiter and Saturn don't respond to the galactic capacitor like the sun does. But the sun has this field that basically electric field contained in a capacitor that goes way out beyond Jupiter. So yes, our sun does respond to that capacitor, whereas Jupiter and Saturn do not. Now let's look at, for example, a moon of Saturn. It's in the ring system. It's sweeping out the ring system. It's a comet relative to the capacitor of Saturn, but it doesn't respond to the solar capacitor because it's in that cocoon, in that shell, in that egg, so to speak, that electrical protected region around Saturn. And so you have to understand how all of this works. So the question is, should we talk about fusion-based objects versus non-fusion-based objects? And the answer is absolutely. You have to distinguish those because the fusion-based objects are creating their own capacitor with a proton wind. They measured the proton wind coming off Jupiter and Saturn, and they don't want to talk about it. It's one of those pretend things that NASA doesn't want to talk about, but I saw the data. It's there. It's true. And, what are the two kind of rings? This was the third question. Is our sun a comet too? And the answer is yes. It's responding to the galactic fusion capacitor, and it's acting as a comet. And it does. It has a tail. It has a nose side. It has an electrical discharge. all kinds of interactions going on there. So yes, our sun acts like a comet too, a plasma discharged comet. Okay, what are the two types of rings? And I actually talked about this before. The Io, the moon, the innermost moon of Jupiter, has a big ring of sulfur dioxide. It looks like a donut. And Io moves right inside that donut. The standard scientific explanation has always been that that is being sputtered off the planet, or the moon, Io, and that's where this is coming from. And the real answer is that no, it's coming in, it's being drawn into Io. It's a part of the local discharge, and Io is electrically charged, so it's drawing this material in, and it's all of this material in the ring is trying to catch up to Io. And Io is discharging to Jupiter. You can actually see the auroral zones when Io moves around. That was one of the first amazing discoveries about when they started looking at Jupiter in ultraviolet light, was that as Io moved around Jupiter in its orbit, there were two electrical connections that connected between Io and Jupiter. Now, I want to stop and talk about that for just a minute, because in historical biblical references, there is references when they're talking about the big comets, and it's very clear they're talking about the big comets, and these are in biblical references, they talk about the horns of the bull. And that's what these are. When you have a major big comet, like Venus, that was moving through the solar system in the biblical days, back in the Old Testament, the electrical current paths that come out the nose side of the comet are they look like the horns of a bull. They're rounded, and that's exactly what Io is doing to Jupiter. It has the horns of the bull electrical discharge on the Jupiter side. In other words, Venus would have had the same thing but connected to the sun. And so Venus would have looked like this huge, raging comet with two big horns coming out the front. And they look just like the horns of a bull when you see them. And now we've got many comets that have also exhibited the horns of the bull. And these are electrical discharges. It's part of the plasma effect of the Mikani plasma discharge comet model. So when you see those biblical references to the horns of the bull, they're talking about comets, and they're talking about that electrical discharge, and Io is such a beautiful, perfect example in modern life. You can see it, and NASA knows it's there. They even admit it. I'm surprised they didn't let that data get swept under the rug. Very, very important. And now possibly you're seeing why it's so vastly important to understand the moons of Jupiter and how they interact with Jupiter, and the fact that Jupiter is a small star, because now we have proof that Io, the innermost Galilean of the four big moons of Jupiter, is interacting with Jupiter with the horns of the bull. And so this is part of my plasma discharge comet model, a very essential part. But you see how it explains ancient observations. Or, for example, that when Velikovsky talked about Venus becoming a planet, all of the other comet models out there talk about the comet being small and then going away. Well, none of them explain what Velikovsky's read into the eyes of the ancient, into the ancient text, that Venus grew and became a planet, and then it nestled into that orbit inside Earth. Well, that's one of the big mysteries in standard astronomy. They can't figure out how that happened, and since they can't figure out how it happened, then doggone, it sure can't exist if they don't know about it, being next to godliness. I've heard astronomers say that, that astronomy is the most godlike sciences. Oh my goodness, please, barf. But anyway, no, the reality is that it's the tail drag, And this is one of the mistakes that Velikovsky made. And I've talked about this when I was on the debate on Coast to Coast AM with Dr. David Morrison, NASA's top scientist, cometary scientist. He was Carl Sagan's student when I debated him on Coast to Coast. I said right at the beginning, I said, let's get it right out, the mistakes that Velikovsky made. And one was talking about electricity and comets, because the ancients talked about electricity, but Velikovsky was not a scientist. And really, he made a tactical error by trying to become a scientist and using the theories of the 1950s to explain his observations that he saw through the ancient texts. Velikovsky was a historian. He was a linguist. And so he should have never stepped out of that. And what he should have said is, look, there's no modern explanation in modern science, but this is what the ancients said. And he should have just left it at that. He should have known, like, for example, I'm not good at shingling a roof. So I'm not going to go up in my roof and put shingles on. I'm not good at it. I don't like it. And I would do a terrible job. So if I want shingles on my roof, I'll tell somebody else, you go do that. I'm not going to put shingles on my roof. And so Velikovsky should have understood that he is not a scientist, and more than likely, the scientific theories of the 1950s were totally incorrect. He should have at least, you know, had an intuition that that was the case. And so, but he was a nice guy. And hey, in his world, nice guys don't win. And I'll tell you something, I have rather thick skin that I've developed over the decades. And no, when it comes to NASA scientists and NASA baloney, no, I'm not a nice guy. Never have been, never will be. Those guys are a bunch of yo-yo clown idiots. But they're tier two. They're tier one science, and those guys know what's going on. They talk to me, and they understand my work. But they're not going to tell the NASA guys, because those are tier two, and they just let them play around in the dirt in their sandbox, because that's what they're there for. They're there to misguide the public. That's the whole reason NASA visibility is there, to keep you from going into outer space, to keep you from understanding real science. And so that's why they're there. But in the real world, they'll never understand real science topics, because they're muddling around in their albatross archaic dinosaur theories. But okay, so anyway, it's important to understand this, because you have to understand there's other issues here, because there's another group of people who don't want you to understand the Bible and what the Bible means. So there's a lot of what you might call political issues in the world of science dealing with the whole issue. But back to Velikovsky, he should have just told them, hey, this is what the ancient texts are saying. This is what it means. This is they're saying that Venus became a planet from a big comet that came around Jupiter. And don't try and explain it, Immanuel Velikovsky. Don't try and explain it, because all those reasons that I've already given. Okay, but how does a comet become a planet? Well, this is all explained in my work. It's the work that I did. This was in the late 1970s. I showed that it's the tail drag. It's not electrical forces. The electrical forces on a comet are really small, because the charge to mass ratio on a comet is extremely small. So it's not an electrical force. And this is something the people that try and copy my work, they run around, jump up and down, they go, electrical forces, electrical forces. No. If you understand how it works, the electrical forces on a comet, even though it's highly charged, is very small, because it has a tremendous amount of mass compare a comet nucleus to an electron, to a proton, to a piece of dust. The largest piece of material in outer space that's going to have electrical effects is going to be something around the size of a pea. A pea. You know, a little thing you eat, you know, a pea. Or a maximum a golf ball. That's about the biggest thing in outer space. And you can do the calculations. the surface charge and the charge to mass ratio of an object, a little piece of rock out in outer space. That's probably the biggest object in outer space that's going to have an electrical effect on its motion. Anything bigger, hey, forget about it. The charge to mass ratio is way too small. Gravity will dominate. And I proved this in all of my writings and in my calculations and things that don't generally hit the public eye or not in my books necessarily, and that's why I'm doing these shows to try and get up to a bit higher level. But yeah, that's the biggest object in outer space that's going to have an electrical orbital effect. Bigger than that, the charge to mass ratio is too small, gravity will dominate. So how does a comet that's electrically charged become a planet? Well, the other thing it's doing is that electrical charge is drawing in material. All those ions, all those water molecules, all those hydrocarbons, all of those nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, sulfur-hydrogen, sulfur-oxygen compounds, all that stuff, iron, is all being drawn into the comet nucleus. And if the nucleus is big enough, it's going to hold those materials gravitationally, not electrically, gravitationally, because they become neutralized. As soon as they get into that region around the comet, they become neutralized. There's lots of electrons there. They're not going to be positively charged anymore. So they're going to settle down and land on the comet nucleus and just stay there. And as the comet builds up mass, it's a drag. It creates a drag, and that causes the circularization of orbit, and it causes the orbit to spiral inwards. And so eventually, the comet becomes a planet, and it does it in a relatively short period of time. In my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, in the appendices, I put some of the published papers, and they go through some calculations, and I show that a planet the size of Venus would circularize its orbit and become a planet in a period of about 600 years, which is about what the ancients talk about. If you look at, my estimate is that according to the Velikovsky timetable, and I stay away from dates myself, but I think Velikovsky was the closest to having it right. That's why I use his times, although he might be off too. Because calendars and dates are very difficult to deal with. But let's say that Venus was captured by Jupiter around 4,200 years ago. Okay, it took 600 years to come in, interact with Mars, tore the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars, leaving the red hulk of the planet we see today. It came by Earth on two different occasions. The Mayans had records of that it was 54 years apart when the two incidences of Venus coming by Earth occurred, 54 years apart. And then it started to migrate inwards, and they were very concerned. In Zimbabwe and South America, Central America, the Incas, or the pre-Incas, I'm sorry, not the Incas we talk about today, but the pre-Incas, the Olmecs, which were the very early descendants of the very early ancestors of the Maya, and the Aztecs, the Olmecs were, a couple thousand B.C. They probably saw and witnessed Venus, and of course all of the other Velikovsky stories. I'm not going to go into those tonight. The Exodus, the Israelites following Moses, that was during that time. All of the cultures around the world talk about that. But once Venus got inside of Earth's orbit, it started to slowly spiral inwards, and they were very, very aware of Venus. They watched it like a hawk. It dominated their calendars. It dominated their religions, their mythology, everything, because, hey, they knew what that baby could do. And eventually it settled into where it is today, and it's kind of been lost into antiquity. But Velikovsky dug up that old bag of bones, brought it up, and started talking about it. And there's a lot of people that don't want you to know about that. And so let's go back to Io. The horns of the bull, Io, is a comet in the capacitor of Jupiter, in the fusion capacitor of Jupiter, and it perfectly shows the horns of the bull. Perfect. You see those two auroral spots moving around with Io on Jupiter as Io moves around in its orbit around Jupiter. The horns of the bull. It's their big curved electrical arcs that go between Io and Jupiter. And that's exactly what Venus would have done when it was in its heyday during those 600 years when it was wandering through the solar system. Occasionally they would have seen it as a major big raging comet with the horns of the bull. And that's where the biblical references come from. Okay, so now you can possibly understand why something as obtuse as charge to mass ratio between electrons and protons is important, because it allows you to understand what creates the horns of the bull. And it's a plasma discharge effect of a comet in the capacitor of the sun. And these are relative to magnetic effects. There's all kinds of things going on there that create these. And I'm not going to deal with all of that right now. But someday, I'm sure there's going to be students who take the data apart, and we're going to have better spacecraft. I hope in my lifetime we're going to have much better spacecraft. We're going to go out to Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond. And we're going to study these phenomena at close range, not like NASA had spacecraft around Jupiter and Saturn for decades and really never did anything relative to these very, very important phenomena. Or if they did, they didn't report it and tell us. And my guess is that the Tier 1 scientists were very much involved in studying these phenomena. I guarantee you they were. But the Tier 2 NASA scientists... let's just make it clear, the Tier 1 scientists work in basically the military and above, and the work they do, they're using these same spacecraft, but they get the data first, and then what's passed off to the Tier 2 NASA guys is basically the garbage data that's already been filtered, homogenized, and pasteurized long before it's been passed off to those guys. Okay, so back to the very first question. Are Jupiter and Saturn planets or stars? Well, they're not planets. Don't call them planets. So let's take two off the planet count. If there were now eight planets, well, there's only six, because Jupiter and Saturn are not planets. They're small, unlit stars. And they're unlit to the naked eye. Let's put it that way. You don't want to look at the sun with your eyes or any type of optical equipment, because it would burn your retinas out. The sun is a very hot, hot glowing ball of gas. Jupiter, on the other hand, look on my webpage, you'll see a thermal signature picture of Jupiter. And Saturn, we also have pictures, thermal pictures of Saturn also. But look at that's not uniform over the surface. If this was just reflected sunlight, then the heat signature would be very uniform, but that's not the case. You have a very illuminated band around the equator. The Great Red Spot and some of the other hurricane storm systems are very much illuminated. Why? Because when the electrical discharges come down into the eye of the storm, that's where the fusion reactions are very strong. So that's why when you look on that picture on my homepage, you're going to see the Great Red Spot highly illuminated, because that's where the electrical current is, and that's what fires off the fusion reactions in the atmosphere. So now understand that, you know, put yourself back in 1979. I'm sitting in my office at Cornell University looking at this for the first time as the data was coming in, understanding all of this, writing about this, and then getting rather... angry responses from the clowns that are there in the Space Science and Astronomy Department. They did not want me using their data to explain what I'm explaining to you on this radio show some almost 40 years later. But, you know, and science today has not advanced. The level, the Tier 2 science, they're still talking about dirty snowballs. They're still talking about Jupiter and Saturn as planets, thinking they're these inert things sitting out there that just twirl around. And no, these are very active little stars, but they're not visibly active. So let's get on to a topic about Saturn here and possibly Jupiter. when Venus came through the solar system, it was interacting very strongly electrically with Jupiter and Saturn. And there are indications historically that Jupiter and Saturn, one or two or the both of them, were lighting up like small stars. In other words, we had more than one lit star in the solar system at one time. And that was the fusion-based activity kicking up because of the electrical interaction with the comet. So when you see me talking about comets interacting with the sun and causing fusion-based reactions, these massive solar corona, coronal ejection, the CME, coronal mass ejections, etc., that come off the sun due to comet activity, you can also see that as hard as they can backpedal, the standard science community is denying that, even though we have thousands of examples of comets interacting with the sun. So anyway, I hope I've answered those five questions, at least on the surface. But now, hopefully, you will understand why sometimes I go into these a little bit more obscure topics like charge-to-mass ratio of an electron versus a proton. Well, what does that have to do with my life? Well, just about everything, if you understand. And this is what causes our weather. This is what causes the, so many things to go on. When I was working with Russian scientists back in the 90s, they had already observed tornadoes running across the surface of the sun, and they're going, what on earth is causing this? They couldn't figure it out. Well, with the plasma discharge comet model, in understanding that hurricanes and tornadoes and cyclonic storms are caused by electrical discharges, and that's part of the discharge process, then they understood. So at any rate, all of this fits together if you understand the electrical nature of the solar system. Oops, I didn't say anything about the second type of ring. I talked about the Io type of ring, which is a donut-shaped ring. But the Saturn types of rings, of course, are the second type. They're the flat rings. And the rings of Saturn are like the old-fashioned record disc, the plastic record disc where the needle would go round and round and round and round and move inwards. You'd put the needle on the outside of the record, and then it would move towards the inside. And that's what the rings of Saturn are like. They're not rings, and so they don't last long. So the whole system of Saturn's rings is primarily composed of water, with the moons that I predicted back in my early published papers, the moons sweeping out the gaps, and those gaps stay relatively constant in constant locations, and that's why they, over the last couple of hundred years, those rings have stayed in relatively the same places, but the rings themselves are moving inward very slowly, but so they're not from something original in the original part of the solar system or whatever. But I'm out of time. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com. Go there, take a look at the pictures of Jupiter. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.